and said they know exactly where he was and they know his location. And then our lawyer asked him, so does that mean that he's working for you? And their response was, that's national security. We cannot discuss this with you guys. So I know for a fact, I've been saying this since day one. This was an FBI sting, FBI entrapment, since day one it came to the media. And I just want people to wake up and see this is not the first time it's happened. It just happened in Ohio again. It happened in New York a couple weeks ago with the three guys. This been going on, and they're targeting people. They're going through their own challenges.
Avni, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue this discussion right after the show and post it at democracynow.org. Avni Osmakach and Trevor Anderson, thanks so much for Trevor Aronson. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
Tune in to Ear to the Streets of Portland on March 19th for an interview with special guest Bay Area recording artist Goapele, who will be performing at this year's KBOO-sponsored event, Sold Out Music Festival, on April 15th. It's a night of special guests and performances on Ear to the Streets of Portland with Goapele and local artists Arietta Ward and friends, March 19th starting at 7 o'clock p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO. Tune in online at kboo.fm, on your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm, and follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio and Twitter at KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio invites you to our springtime open house and live in-studio performance of Mama C, Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m. Tour the KBOO studios and meet your community. Share refreshments and talk with other listeners, program hosts, volunteers, and KBOO staff. See how our communities intersect and work together to create this amazing community radio station. We'll also have a live performance by Mama C, an accomplished musician, poet, and MC, as well as a former Black Panther and political refugee who fled the U.S. in early 1970s for Tanzania. Again, that's Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m., an open house and live performance by Mama C at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We look forward to seeing you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a crude oil transporter in Oregon is fined.
A possible lynching in Mississippi is being investigated by the FBI.
And Oregon becomes the latest focus of anti-union groups trying to cut the funding of public employee and other unions.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 19th, 2015. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Robert Barncord. The body of an African-American man was found hanging from a tree in Mississippi today, according to a statement from the FBI. Local law enforcement officials found the man's body in the woods near his home. The officials were conducting a search for a man who had been missing for 2 weeks. The county sheriff said the man's body was hanging from a bed sheet twisted into a makeshift noose. Two investigations are now examining his death, one by local authorities and another by federal authorities, to determine whether there may be federal civil rights violations. The local NAACP chapter is suggesting that the dead man is 54-year-old Otis Byrd. Mr. Byrd was last seen on March 2nd after a friend dropped him off at a casino in nearby Vicksburg, Mississippi. However, law enforcement officials have not yet released any information on the man's identity. Family members filed a missing persons report on March 8th. A similar possible lynching took place last August in North Carolina when the body of a 17-year-old man, Lennon Lacey, was found hanging from a swing set near his home. Despite evidence that he was murdered, including the fact that his shoes had been replaced by a pair of shoes two sizes too small, detectives ruled in December of 2014 that Lacey's death was a suicide.
The 2015 progress report from the Children First for Oregon shows that the progress has stalled. with a poverty rate that has actually increased since the end of the Great Recession. The report released yesterday makes several recommendations that are timely for the legislature. KBOO's Tarina Aguilar has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
The new progress report for Oregon children, released today, Wednesday, notes that there has been a lack of progress on issues connected to a child's success in life. Children First for Oregon issued the report, which finds a child in Oregon has a 1 in 5 chance of being poor, even if at least one parent works, and that the child poverty rate has increased 10% since the end of the Great Recession. Tanya Hunt at Children First says immediate action needs to be taken by the state's lawmakers.
We're getting to the point where that is costing our state significantly in terms of child well-being, the economy. Overall, the future of our state is at risk if we don't correct course.
The report recommends enacting a $15 an hour minimum wage, expansion of early education, and increasing investments in policies to keep children and families safe, such as home visiting. Sybil Hebb at the Oregon Law Center says poverty is strongly intertwined with barriers to a child's success in life, including domestic violence. Senate Bill 503 is of particular interest to her group. It would expand funding for domestic violence assistance when children are involved, such as paying for new door locks or a hotel room.
Finding ways to step in and provide safety and resources to those victims when they're in that dangerous time of trying to leave an abusive situation and move forward to achieve safety is one of our highest priorities.
Tanya Hunt says while the report makes recommendations for lawmakers, there is action that anyone can take that would help. Children First for Oregon has created United for Kids. She describes it as a statewide pro-child movement.
Sign up to be a part of this movement that simply says kids should be a top priority for our lawmakers and our public policy decision makers in the state.
Details are at orunitedforkids.org. For KBOO News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, I'm Tarina Aguilar.
The owner of an oil train terminal near Clatskanie has agreed to pay a fine for moving 6 times more crude oil through the facility in 2013 than was allowed. The company, Global Partners, will pay just over $100,000 as part of a settlement with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Originally, the state agency had fined the company an additional $15,000, but reduced the fine as part of the settlement agreement. The initial fine considered the violation intentional, but state officials were not able to prove that the company's actions were intentional. Global Partners admitted no wrongdoing as part of the settlement. GEQ is requiring around $80,000 of the penalty money to be spent replacing as many as 20 highly polluting residential wood stoves with modern versions. That money will go to a nonprofit community action team and will be spent in Columbia and Clatsop counties. When the company transitioned from an ethanol to an oil terminal in the year 2012, the Oregon DEQ limited the company to transporting no more than 50 million gallons of crude oil per year. But within the first year of operation, the company was transporting more than 300 million gallons of crude oil. The way DEQ handled the permit change allowed oil trains also to show up in Oregon without the public knowing that they were coming. The state has not prepared sufficiently for possible spills, derailments, or explosive events. 4 trains have exploded in the United States and Canada in just the last 5 weeks. These explosions happen because the volatile gases have not been removed before shipping the crude oil.
Authorities say they're still not certain what caused the explosion that killed a person and shut down a 5-mile stretch of Highway 26 just east of Welch's early this morning. The explosion occurred on the U.S. Forest Service land, and though agents from the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms fielded questions initially, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has since named as the agency leading the investigation. An FBI spokesperson from the evidence response team said the site was being diagrammed to collect evidence, but did add there isn't a reason at this juncture to indicate the explosion is an act of terrorism. Details about the person found dead remain unavailable, and the cause of death is expected to be released by the medical examiner. Federal officials said they don't anticipate the Mount Hood Highway to be between milepost 47 and 52 to reopen until later this evening.
An attorney representing the estate of a 2-year-old boy who investigators believe died when his head was bashed into a toilet at a Portland motel has filed a $2.5 million lawsuit against the Oregon Department of Human Services. The lawsuit alleges that child welfare workers and a Seaside police officer failed to adequately intervene in the years, months, and weeks leading up to young Colton Salisbury's death on March 6th of 2014. Portland attorney Josh Lamburn, who filed the suit Monday, said that the more he learned about the case, the angrier he became. Wendy Salisbury, the mother of Colton and two other children, had a documented history of mental health problems and smoking marijuana to medicate herself. The state of Washington had terminated Salisbury's parental rights to her first child because of abuse or neglect, and her second child was not living with her at the time of Colton's death, according to the lawyer. Salisbury also had a new boyfriend named Joshua Howard, a 28-year-old, who had restraining orders from a previous relationship. He started providing full-time daycare for Colton while Salisbury, age 30, was at work. DHS records show that the agency had received 4 reports of suspected child abuse or neglect while Salisbury was pregnant with Colton or after she gave birth to him. The lawsuit for $2.5 million could be tripled to $7.5 million if a court agrees with the lawyer to classify the child who died as a vulnerable person. The largest payout from a case against the Oregon Department of Human Services was $4.1 million, which was awarded this last December to 2 young girls who were sexually and physically abused by their foster mom.
At the top of the to-do list for improving residents' health in Jackson County, Southern Oregon, is to improve birth outcomes for babies. Jackson Care Connect, which serves the county's Oregon Health Plan members, has created an initiative program to reward expectant mothers for getting care for themselves and their babies. KBOO's Tarina Aguilar has more, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
A Medford health plan is taking a unique approach to encourage new mothers to get their babies off to the best possible start. And it's hoping the idea spreads to other parts of the state. In Jackson County, Jackson Care Connect is rewarding its expectant members for taking healthy steps, whether it's getting to a medical or dental appointment or attending birth or parenting classes. They earn vouchers that can be redeemed at a new store set up for the program called Starting Strong. Program manager Heidi Hill says behind the fun shopping experience, there's a serious message.
We know that women who do not receive prenatal care are 3 times more likely to deliver a low birth weight baby, and those babies are 5 times more likely to die.
Jackson Care Connect sees low-income Oregon Health Plan members, and although their prenatal and well-child visits are covered, Hill says they don't always get the care. She says the Starting Strong store is filled with baby care products. Vouchers can be spent on everyday items like diapers and baby clothes, or saved and combined for larger items such as car seats or high chairs. Of the 2,300-plus babies born in Jackson County in one recent year, 2013, the regional hospital reported 312 needed neonatal intensive care. Hill says that's an expensive and frightening ordeal for new parents when regular prenatal care could have made a difference.
I think the real message is when a healthy baby is born and that relationship is strong between the mother and the child, the community wins as well by having that healthy baby and not having the costs associated with a poor birth outcome.
She adds that for the community partners giving out the Starting Strong vouchers, it's another positive way to interact with young families and keep them coming back. A 2014 county health assessment pinpointed better birth outcomes and reducing substance abuse during pregnancy as 2 top priorities. For KBOO News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, I'm Tarina Aguilar.
2 ballot initiative petitions were filed this week with the Oregon Secretary of State, aiming to allow public employees to opt out of paying union dues. The so-called right-to-work legislation has been passed in 25 states, most visibly in Wisconsin, where Governor Scott Walker signed the law on March 9th after a hastily convened session of the state legislature. The next day, Washington County lawyer Jill Gibson filed 2 petitions and told the Oregonian that she will probably file more to see which title has the most traction with voters. Gibson did not respond to requests for an interview. So far, the only money spent on either petition has been over $1,000 transferred from Gibson's previous initiative committee from the year 2014. But she also said she expects contributions from many of the same companies who funded the previous initiative. That money included $45,000 from Freres Lumber Company and $6,000 from Stimson Lumber Company, both perennial contributors to pro-business and anti-labor politicians and initiatives. The 2014 initiative was withdrawn, along with opposing initiatives aimed at raising corporate taxes at the urging of then-Governor John Kitzhaber, who hoped to reach a broad consensus between business and labor groups. That consensus never materialized, and this year, both business and labor interests say that they will be more aggressive and will not back down. A coalition of labor groups, Our Oregon, has so far filed 7 similarly titled initiatives aimed at increasing the annual minimum tax on corporations with sales of over $25 million per year. They also had similar initiatives on the ballot in 2014, and they backed off at Governor Kitzhaber's request. Given that both sides have stated their determination to not withdraw their initiatives, no matter who begs them to, the battle surrounding workers' rights on Oregon's 2016 ballot promises to be one of the most costly and divisive of the election season.
Only about 17% of Oregon workers are represented by unions, and over half of them work in the public sector. That low percentage is still more than the national average of 11.3%, which is a significant decrease from 30 years ago when around 20% of the American workforce belonged to unions. Despite these low numbers, unions are significant players in Oregon politics through lobbying and campaign funding, and many on the union side feel that the right-to-work laws are thinly veiled attempts to decrease the political power of unions by drying up their source of funding, namely membership dues. For a union perspective on right-to-work initiatives in Oregon, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Bob Livingstone, legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council.
I think like all workers, firefighters and nurses alike and others, is that working families need to stand up to the corporations and out-of-state billionaires that are trying to cut our pay and reduce our benefits. For the men and women I serve with every day, it's important that our voices are heard and that we have the ability to negotiate for a safe working environment and for reasonable wages. And not only do these measures threaten our safety, but they come at a time when many working families are struggling. And we believe we should work to make a positive difference in the lives of Oregonians. That's why we are working to help other groups improve minimum wage and paid sick time for workers throughout Oregon. And we think it's long overdue that the middle class fight back.
Do you think that the rhetoric surrounding this from the right to work side, that this legislation is purely aimed at giving workers a greater choice in who represents them, whether it's just themselves or a particular union? Do you think that that holds any water at all?
No, I don't think this issue of choice is. I don't think the middle class has had much choice over the last 20 years when we've seen wages stay stagnant while billionaires and the one percenters have continued to receive more and more pay. And we should not kid ourselves that this is outside influence. This is Koch brothers, Lauren Parks, and Sizemore-like tactics that would divide us at a time where we think Oregonians should stay united and focus on issues that help the middle class and those that are less fortunate become part of the middle class.
In 2014, there was another one of these petitions headed towards the ballot, as well as one coming from Our Oregon, and I believe several other supporters that would have raised taxes on corporations, and both of those petitions were withdrawn at the request of former Governor Kitzhaber. Is that at all likely to happen again this year?
You know, I can't speak to whether there's going to be trades of ballot measures. I certainly hope that we wouldn't have to even get into that kind of conversation, and that really we should focus on those things that are important and what I think we here in Oregon are doing, and that is to try to stand up to the billionaires and push back and fight for the middle class and fight for workers and improve the lives of of common Oregonians. And we think that's really the focus that we're trying to attempt to do, and think that that's the right tactic for Oregon.
Given that, I believe it's 17% of Oregon's workforce is unionized and most of that is public sector, do you feel that unions are particularly strong in Oregon right now?
I think the unions play a huge role, not just here in Oregon, but throughout our nation. And if you look back at history, when the middle class wages were able to share with profits and to help pay for college educations and those kind of things, I don't think it was a coincidence that union membership was at a higher level. And so we think that the unions help to not only make workplaces safer, but they make the lives of middle-class Americans much better. And I think history has proven that.
All right. Bob Livingston, thank you very much for talking with us today.
All right. Take care.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Bob Livingston, the legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council.
In just a year, Spain's anti-austerity Podemos party has grown from nothing to become the most popular party in opinion polls. Its rapid rise and the recent victory of an anti-austerity party in Greece has the political establishment worried, just ahead of national elections later in the year. In only the last few weeks, the party has come under increased scrutiny, with critics testing its populist rhetoric. And this weekend, Podemos faces its first domestic electoral test during a regional vote in the province of Andalusia. Nick Martin, with our friends at Free Speech Radio News, reports.
Algunos querrían que las elecciones se pararan ya.
Podemos leader Pablo Iglesias rallies supporters in the southern city of Malaga. His party will soon face the first of several regional elections here in Spain's most populous province. Stretching from the border with Portugal to the tip of the southeastern coast, Andalusia has been a stronghold of the socialist PSOE party since the end of the dictatorship of Francisco Franco in the mid-1970s. When the 2008 financial crisis hit Spain, a massive protest movement saw hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets, campaigning against public sector cuts and job losses. Podemos emerged out of the leaderless Indignados movement, seizing on the anger felt by ordinary Spaniards.
They occupy an emotional space that couldn't possibly be filled by any other party in the center-left in Spain.
That's Manuel Arias Maldonado, a political scientist at the University of Malaga.
The Communist Party, they must be very bitter now, you know, because the program is very similar to Podemos. I mean, they have been supporting this discourse for years, but they have never succeeded electorally. But Izquierda Unida couldn't possibly perform this cathartical or purification function because their brand was tarnished. They sat down in the boards of the public banks who were busted, you know. They were sat down there along with other political parties and with the unions. So they could not represent the new.
Andalusia has the highest unemployment rate in the whole of the European Union. It's also a rural farming zone. And while Podemos' social media campaigns have mobilized young and urban fans, they have yet to resonate with many traditional voters. Manuel López sits on the party's Citizens Council.
It is true that Andalusia is a difficult place because of the traditional support for the socialists and also the ruling Popular Party, or PP, which is also strong. But polls suggest that our popularity is still growing and that nothing is decided yet.
But critics think Podemos' strategy of a cooperative democracy is too simplistic. Among them, Professor Maldonado.
They're saying that the situation will be solved via some kind of magical trick, via more participation, although they don't explain how that will be, you know, implemented, via rewriting of the constitution. And in that way, they are just refraining from a deeper debate about how to solve our problems. And people are buying that.
The new party, however, has been able to harness a certain sense of optimism that they can deliver.
Teresa es nuestra mejor candidata para ganar las elecciones en Andalucía.
It's raised around $500,000 for the regional campaign and spent much of it on television advertising. Podemos has been polling almost 20% in Andalusia, not as high as nationally, but enough to become the second or third largest party in the regional parliament. But some polls suggest the party may have peaked. It now faces a challenge from another anti-establishment group, Ciudadanos, a centre-right party which some say has clearer policies for change. In the small town of Almeñeca, resident Marie Carmen Garcia says she's still undecided about who to pick.
I think Ciudadanos is more respectable than Podemos. Podemos maybe says things that people want to hear, but they don't really explain what will they do. Most of the people we don't trust anymore in the politicians. Me, for example. Older people, they're a little bit scared about changing, but I think it's time to change. I know who will not get my vote.
In recent weeks, much of the Spanish media has turned on the young upstarts, printing allegations about leaders' tax affairs and speculation that the party is receiving money from the government of Venezuela. But spokesperson Manuel López vows that if elected, Podemos will clean up Spanish politics.
We are going to raise transparency to levels currently unthinkable. We're going to endow the media so that corruption can truly be fought and so that there is real accountability of how public money is spent. But more than that, we want the public to be able to follow in real time where the money is being spent.
But as the country heads towards the national vote in December, the knives are out for Podemos. These regional elections should indicate just how the new party will perform and if it has enough momentum to put a sizable dent in the country's political establishment. Nick Martin, FSRN, Malaga.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for testimony from the Oregon State Legislature in support of a ban on gay conversion therapy for youth in Oregon. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area is cloudy with a high of 65 and a 20% chance of rain. Today in history, on March 19, 1918, the U.S. Congress approves daylight savings time. Germany started the use of daylight savings time in 1916, and other countries followed suit. Daylight savings time, or British summer time, is the practice of adjusting clocks forward 1 hour near the start of spring so that afternoons have more daylight and mornings have less, and adjusting them backwards in autumn by 1 hour. This is not used universally worldwide, but it is common in Europe and North America. The quote of the day is from civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., who said, 300 years of humiliation, abuse, and deprivation cannot be expected to find a voice in a whisper.
It's 5:27 and time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Near my home in Austin, Texas, there's an old refurbished motel with a keep it real attitude that is expressed right on its iconic marquee. No additives, no preservatives, corporate free since 1938. The good news is that more and more businesses across the country are adopting this attitude, providing a buy local, uncorporate, anti-chain alternative for customers. Food shoppers and restaurant goers, for example, have made a huge shift in recent years away from the likes of McDonald's, Pepsi, and Taco Bell, preferring upstart independent outfits with names like The Corner, Caleb's Cola, and U.S. Taco Company. But, uh-oh, guess who owns those little alternatives? Right, McDonald's, PepsiCo, and Taco Bell. Leave it to ethically challenged profiteering monopolists to grab such value-laden terms as genuine and honest, empty them of any authenticity, then hurl them back at consumers as shamefully deceptive marketing scams. In Huntington Beach, California, U.S. Taco Company poses as a hip surfer haunt with a colorful Day of the Dead Mexican skull as its logo. The airy place peddles lobster tacos and other fancifuls at $3 or $4 each. Very unfast foodie. Nowhere is it whispered that this is a big chain outlet created by a group of Taco Bell insiders. They even usurped the enterprising word entrepreneur, stripped it of its outsider connotation, and twisted it into a corporate vanity, calling themselves intrapreneurs. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, reality will out. Small and local has a genuine feel and flavor that the imitators can't sustain as they sprawl out into 10,000 stores. And as they do, it becomes obvious to customers that they've been duped, and that's not a good marketing strategy. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
A Portland-area lesbian couple is awaiting a judge's ruling on how much compensation they will receive for being discriminated against by the owners of Sweet Cakes by Melissa in Gresham. The couple sued the owners of Sweet Cakes after being refused service for being a same-sex couple. The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, which took up the case, recommended an amount of $75,000 to each woman. The judge was expected to rule on Wednesday, but said it could take up to another 30 days. The plaintiff, Rachel Bowman Cryer, explained that she wanted to choose Sweet Cakes to make her wedding cake because her mother had her wedding cake made by them 3 years before. When she went to a scheduled cake tasting on January 17, 2013, she describes being asked by the baker owner, Aaron Klein, what the names of the bride and groom were. When she responded that it was a two-bride wedding, he replied with, "Well, we may have been wasting your time." He later explained that Sweet Cakes would not be making any wedding cakes for a same-sex couple. Bowman Cryer described her emotional response as feeling like being punched in the gut, and making her doubt whether anyone would accept her and her partner's marriage. An Oregon judge ruled in January of this year that Sweet Cakes owners Melissa and Aaron Klein were guilty of violating the rights of Bowman Cryer and her partner.
In San Diego, the city and Unified Port District took legal action earlier this week against Monsanto to pay for its role in polluting the local bay and tidal areas with polychlorinated biphenyls, commonly known as PCBs. The suit contends that Monsanto concealed the hazards associated with PCBs despite their awareness of the health risks associated with the chemical compounds, going all the way back to the 1930s. Other assertions include that PCBs manufactured by Monsanto have been found in the sediment, in the water, and also identified in the tissues of marine life in the bay. Legal remedies sought from the court go beyond just recouping the costs of removing the PCBs from the bay. They also request payment for the loss of natural resources.
Nomura Holdings Incorporated, a Japanese investment company implicated in the 2008 economic crisis, is on trial after being sued by the Federal Housing Finance Agency by misrepresenting risky mortgages underlying securities it sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The undependable loans totaled more than $2 billion and were underwritten by Royal Bank of Scotland. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was taken over by the federal government after the crisis to avoid them from going under and having to declare bankruptcy, and now are represented by the Federal Housing Finance Agency, or FHFA. The FHFA filed 18 lawsuits in 2011, totaling more than $200 billion in damages, against banks such as J.P. Morgan and the Bank of America that were accused of selling insecure loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a crucial element identified as precipitating in the 2008 financial crisis. Many of those suits have been settled out of court before going to trial, and have so far totaled only $18 billion in fines. The case against Nomura is the first to be contested by a bank. If Nomura wins the case, it could embolden other accused banks to defend themselves in court rather than settle. The trial is expected to go on for 1 month, with the judge calling for closing arguments on April 8th.
The five-member board of the Federal Communications Commission has been appearing before a congressional review board in the past week as part of efforts by congressional Republicans to investigate the FCC's recent ruling designating the Internet under Title II regulations. Republicans have criticized FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler's pro-Title II decision, claiming that he switched his stance after President Obama publicly came out in favor of Title II. Chairman Wheeler has appeared so far before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, also the Senate Commerce Committee. He appeared today before the House Telecommunications Subcommittee, which is chaired by Oregon Representative Greg Walden. Chairman Wheeler will then have to appear before the House Appropriations Subcommittee. Finally, he will have to appear before the House Judiciary Committee. Congressional Republicans are considering legislation that would impede upon the FCC's Internet ruling. Here is a recording of some of the questioning of Tom Wheeler taken from C-SPAN.
The next questioner will be the general lady from Tennessee, Ms. Blackburn, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. Chairman Wheeler, I will just add my viewpoint of when you look at our economic revolutions in society, whether it was the agricultural or the industrial, the technology, the information, successful revolutions are about freeing up, not restricting. And what we're looking at right now is the vantage point from that you all are coming from is taking away and restricting, not freeing up.
The gentleman from Illinois is now recognized for 5 minutes.
Chairman Wheeler, earlier you said that if asked to regulate rates, that the commission would make it clear that the commission will not regulate retail rates on broadband. Would you agree that a prohibition on the commission regulating broadband rates is consistent with your views?
So I have said repeatedly that we are not trying to regulate rates that, again, if Congress wants to do something in that
sure.
regard, that's Congress's authority.
You're not interested in, but what about the next FCC commissioner? Do you believe that under Title II that they have the authority to regulate rates now? And I respect that you don't want to, but you've created something that will now be passed down through generations of FCC commissioners.
Well, as I said in my earlier response, if this comes before us while I'm there, I hope that without prejudging the issue, that we can build a record that will make it difficult for that to happen.
But you could understand.
And Congress
then,
clearly has the authority to do something.
You could understand.
They would like to do
you
something.
You could understand our concern. You know, again, we respect when you say, I have no intention of doing it. That's great. But you can understand the concern of Congress where you implement a rule and then, in essence, say, I don't have any intention of regulating rates, but I'm not going to prevent. The next commission could do it.
Yeah, one of the things that we did was we patterned this after Section 332 and the regulation of mobile voice. And for 22 years, this exact same authority has rested at the commission for mobile voice service and never been used.
So if legislation that said, notwithstanding any provision of law, the Federal Communication Commission may not regulate the rates charged for broadband Internet access service, that would be consistent with that view.
That is what we are trying to accomplish.
Okay.
That was Federal Communications Commission Chairman Tom Wheeler being questioned before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, March 19, 2015. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities and injure the Palestinian man, and in Gaza, Israeli Navy attack fishermen. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A young man has been shot and seriously injured on Wednesday at night by an Israeli army live round near the Al Jalazon refugee camp north of the central West Bank city of Ramallah, Palestinian medical sources reported. Ali Muhammad Safi, 20 years of age, was shot and seriously injured by live rounds directly to the chest. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition at local youth during clashes that took place after the army invaded the area. Several residents have also been injured during ensued clashes, but their wounds have been described as mild. Several military vehicles have been deployed in the area, closing a number of roads and obstructing Palestinian traffic. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday at dawn various Palestinian communities in occupied West Bank, stormed and ransacked homes, and kidnapped 9 Palestinians. Several military armored vehicles invaded several towns in the southern West Bank district of Hebron and kidnapped 6 civilians. In addition, soldiers invaded Silwad town in the central West Bank district of Ramallah and kidnapped a journalist. 2 more Palestinians have also been kidnapped from their homes in the northern West Bank city of Jenin and the Jenin refugee camp. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli Navy ships attacked on Thursday morning a number of fishing boats in Palestinian territorial waters near Gaza City and fired rounds of live ammunition at them. The Navy also chased the Palestinian fishing boats, forcing them to sail back to shore in a Sudanese area northwest of Gaza City. The attack is part of daily Israeli assaults against Gaza fishers and also comes in direct violations of all previous mediated ceasefire agreements, in addition to violating the Oslo Accords. The current 6 nautical miles fishing zone also falls short of the 20 nautical miles allocated to Palestinian fishermen in the 1993 Oslo Accords and comes in direct violations of every ceasefire agreement, including the latest ceasefire deal mediated by Egypt on August 26, 2014. Earlier in the week, a Palestinian fisher was killed by Israeli Navy fire and 2 others were kidnapped. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, March 19th, 2015 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Maui and me, Vassam Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Ethan Martin, and Tarina Aguilar. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to reporters from Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jackie Malmstrom. Here's what's coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's an hour of Democracy Now!, a news magazine hosted by award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, join us for Positively Revolting Talk Radio with hosts Ani and Lynn. Topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. From 9 to noon, we present a special public affairs programming. This weekend marks the one-year anniversary of a catastrophic mudslide in Oso, Washington, that killed 43 people. A year later, many questions about the mudslide and what led up to it have still not been answered. Tomorrow, KBOO Radio will have a special program from 9 a.m. to noon that looks into the geology and human activities that led up to the slide and the lessons that can be learned from the disaster. The Oregon House of Representatives passed a bill this week that prevents parents from inflicting so-called gay conversion therapy on youth under 18 in the state of Oregon. The bill is known as the Youth Mental Health Protection Act, and it now moves to the Oregon Senate for approval. Groups including the American Medical Association and the American Psychological Association have come out against the so-called therapy. The groups say that this type of practice, which tries to convert LGBT youth to be straight, Studies have shown that it can lead to depression, destructive behavior, and in some cases, suicide. Here is a segment of the testimony in committee hearings that led up to the bill's passage this week.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Gina Frazzini, and I serve as the Executive Director of Basic Rights Oregon. And I'm pleased to bring forward House Bill 2307, the Youth Mental Health Protection Act, on behalf of our tens of thousands of constituents all over the state. Basic Rights Oregon, as many of you know, works to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Oregonians experience equality. And we believe that this legislation is a clear and tangible step to ensuring our state is one that prioritizes the safety and affirmation of our youth, particularly our LGBTQ youth. As the organizational sponsor of this bill, we strongly urge your support for House Bill 2307. This will ensure that licensed professional health care providers do not subject Oregon youth to harmful conversion therapy. This conversion therapy includes a range of dangerous and discredited practices aimed at changing a person's sexual orientation or suppressing a person's gender identity or expression. I want to thank each and every member of this committee for meeting with us in the past week about this bill or talking with us and asking such thoughtful questions. We've worked hard to address your questions, and you'll hear answers to them today from a broad set of experts and individuals impacted by conversion therapy. We believe that every LGBT child is born perfect, and that any young person's identity as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender should be honored, celebrated, and supported. Conversion therapy practices are based on the false claim that being LGBT is a mental illness that can and should be cured. And every leading health and mental health professional association in this country has rejected that view, and they have deemed conversion therapy treatments as ineffective, harmful, and dangerous. But unfortunately, our current Oregon law does not protect young people or their families from being coerced and subjected to these harmful practices, and that puts our young people at risk for depression, for decreased self-esteem, for substance abuse, and suicide. Some people have wondered if the bill's needed and if the practice persists in this day and age. I've heard a lot. And there are so many stories from members of our community who've been harmed by this.